So when Luke and I got together to start planning the sermon series for 2025, one of the things that really came up to us through conversations with people both in the church and out were just this like lack of belief in our significance. And do we matter? And am I more than just a drop in the ocean? And can I make a difference? And so we started this sermon series with identity, who we are in Christ. And then we talked about authenticity, who you are as an individual. And now we're going to talk about courage to live into our full identities. So, Wisdom, can you pass out the clipboards? That was the thing I forgot. Put the boards and pens and stuff. As has been the theme throughout this month, we've kind of begun each sermon with some reflection time. Because I know that in our busy schedule, it's time to make space to reflect. So I'm going to play a bit of music, and there are questions, and there are pens coming around as well. But the question, the main theme of the question is, do you feel free to be you? And do you feel pressure to wear a mask at work, at home, out and about, at church? Do you feel that there are times that you need to hide part of your identity? Have you ever been misidentified? How did it make you feel? Have you ever tried to live into an identity that wasn't authentic to you? That's kind of a throwback from last week as we talked about being our own self. So I'm going to put on this song. I'm going to give you guys about 3 to 5 minutes to think, journal, reflect, and then we're going to dive in. I'm going to ask anybody to share, just kind of like we've been doing all this month, but I hope that time was helpful for you. And we're going to talk about, today we're going to talk about Esther. And if you haven't read the book of Esther in a while, I mean, the plot really could be an episode of Game of Thrones. Like, it is a book full of assassins, just people being betrayed in the court, impaling, like, there's just a lot that happens in this book that when I was rereading it, I was like, man, this really feels like something I could have watched on TV. So let's talk a little bit about Esther's historical background. So this is, Esther is written for the diaspora Jews who did not return to Jerusalem. Okay? So this is the Persian Empire, approximately 50 to 60 years after Jews were returned to Jerusalem, were permitted to return. Not all Jews went back. Most of them did. But like, so that's where we are right now. And then this one I think a lot of people knew, but just so we're clear, because it comes up and it's important to the story, is the Jews were still very Jewish. Everyone knew, like, we're the Persians, and then there are the Jews, because they followed their own set of laws and rules and religion, and they didn't assimilate into the culture around them.
Were the Jews slaves at that time still, though?
No. Okay. No. They're not slaves. They're just a kind of in the empire, kind of a looked down upon group. And then there's a whole lot of debate about the genre of Esther, okay? Like, so some people say it's a historical nonfiction narrative, period, full stop, that's all it is. Some people argue that it's a historical novel, right? Because, like, Esther is just really well written, and it doesn't feel like just dates and dead dudes, but, like, they argue that it is history. It's just someone, it's like Hamilton, right? You, like, nobody really cared about Hamilton until Lin-Manuel Miranda wrote a epic Broadway play. And is that history? No, it's a historical drama, but it is very faithful to the text. And then other people just say, nope, screw it, it's just a parable or a fable. That's all it is. I fall more into the historical novel category only because the difference in the writing styles, because of when you read like 1st, 2nd Samuel, 1st Kings, 1st Chronicles, like, they put you to sleep, you know? And then if you read Esther, you're like, ooh, what's going to happen next? Like, it just, it reads more exciting, excitedly. So I, but either way, it could be a historical nonfiction narrative. The story of Esther has a lot to teach us. So I would argue the genre doesn't really matter, but I do like to point that out. And then lastly, it's the only book where God, Yahweh, Adonai, Lord is not mentioned, right? Which is another reason. Yes, that's another reason I learned lean towards novel. Because when we're talking about the history, God usually is very clear on what he, like, God said this. Whereas if you're writing a historical novel, there's a lot of, like, God behind the scenes. But I feel like the author wasn't going to be like, and then God said this, when they didn't know what God said. All right. So let's talk about the story so far, because I did not, as much as I would love to, I do not have time to go through all of Esther today. So first we have Queen Vashti. Now I love Queen Vashti for a different reasons, right? Because we have, we also have King Xerxes. King Xerxes is throwing a huge party, right? And everybody is just having a really good time. There's lots of alcohol, there's lots of food, everyone is happy. And then King Xerxes is like, I want Vashti to come here and I want to show her off. It's the only thing he wants. He wants to show off how beautiful his queen is. And she's like, no. No thanks, I'll pass. And then King Xerxes, who throughout the text of Esther, he is someone who never has his own thought. He's very much a, what do you think I should do? How about you? What do you guys see? So he gets his advisors together. And he says, guys, she disrespected me. What should I do? And of course, this being a bunch of men, they immediately went, well, if Queen Vashti can disrespect the king, then all our wives are just going to do whatever the heck they want to do. So I think that we should just get rid of her completely. That's it. Get rid of her. They're like, so, and then they do. They dispose Queen Vashti. They don't kill her, but it was basically, you know, she would have been fed to the dogs, essentially, left out there. And then they pass an edict that women have to listen to their husbands, right? That's the new law of the land. All because Queen Vashti didn't want to be shown off as a trophy, right? So I have a lot of sympathy for Queen Vashti. She is not portrayed as the villain in this story at all. And then being like, well, now I need a new queen. So we go to, let's get all of the virgins around that are pretty enough for me. And like, I'm going to see which one pleases me the best. Because that's, you know, what you do when you're looking for love, right? Like, I'll just bring all of the single people here, and I'll take my picks, right? And so he does that, and they get one night with the king kind of thing.
The Bachelor.
Yeah, The Bachelor. Yes, very similar to The Bachelor.
Only you don't have a choice.
You don't have a choice. Yeah. There are some words I use, but there are children present. So, anyway, then we have Queen Esther, okay? And, okay, talk about... This is a pet peeve of mine. It took me forever to find a picture of Queen Esther that looked vaguely Jewish and not white. Like, I was just, like, digging. And this actually came from the New York Times in 2020. I didn't read the article, but it was very interesting because it was an opinion article that said, Queen Esther, the hero we need today, or something. And I was just, like, very fascinated about this. Don't have time, but I want to read that later. But here's, so we had Queen Esther. And she becomes queen because she pleases the king. And she's, in the start of the story, kind of very timid. So both of her parents have died. She's being raised by her uncle Mordecai, right? And he treats her just like a daughter. And she kind of just does whatever Mordecai says. And then we have these two foils. We have our friend Haman, who, and Mordecai. And Haman is portrayed as basically an evil fool, right? And then we have Haman, who is portrayed as someone who is wise and seeking after God. And Haman gets a bee in his bonnet because Mordecai refuses to bow down to him. And we know the text doesn't say why. If I had to guess, it would be because he wasn't going to bow down to anyone that wasn't God. But I don't know. The text doesn't say. It just says he doesn't bow down. And then Haman absolutely loses it. Okay? He's like, I'm going to kill him and I'm going to kill all of his people. Right? So Haman is very much portrayed as a hothead. These are foils, okay? And this is, again, why I feel like it's leaning more towards a novel or novella, because, like, it's just the characterization is just so much more different than you have in other places. So we have Haman and Mordecai, and they, you know, when I thought about this, you know, this is like Hamilton and Burr, Captain America versus Tony Stark, you know, Philadelphia Eagles versus whoever their rival is. I don't know when Steve got help me out. What?
Cowboys.
Okay. Wow, the Cowboys suck. How could that be a rival? Like, anyway, sorry. I'm off. Okay, sorry, off topic. But there's a rivalry happening. You understand my point. All right. So Esther goes, and this is before she becomes queen, but it says Esther had not revealed her nationality and family background because Mordecai had forbidden her to do so. Every day he walked back and forth near the courtyard of the harem to find out how Esther was and what was happening to her, right? Because he cares about her, right? And I know we have a lot of negative connotations about the word harem. It really was the portion of the household where all of the women lived. So it wasn't necessarily some of the things we see in Hollywood.
It was the sorority.
It was a sorority house, but yes, the king did have his pick of women from most of the women that were there. But it was
like
not
a sorority.
Yeah. There you go. But Esther didn't say, she didn't, you know, start with, oh, I'm a Jew, right? Because in that, it would have immediately looked down upon her. And she was already there. It wasn't like she was getting out of there, right? And so I would say that there are times, for the sake of prudence or safety, where we do not have to reveal our whole selves. So we talked about authenticity last time, and I think there, you know, we can be authentic without necessarily saying everything we need to say. You know, you don't need to word vomit on people. And there are times, like, people ask, like, oh, is it ever time to, like, when you're a missionary, right, and you're in a closed country, you don't apply on the visa, I'm coming to spread the gospel, right? Like, everyone knows back here that's what you're doing, right? But that's not what you say. There are times where it may not be safe based, maybe it's political views, right? You're like, I can't share that I voted for this guy in this space because I know that everyone's going to be mad at me, right? And so some of it is safety. Some of it is, you know, the LGBT community. There's a reason we have a coming out, like, because it's scary, right? And so there are times where we don't need to reveal our whole selves. So I want to start there. But then we get into, oh, whoops, I forgot. All right, sorry. Where have you felt it prudent to hide part of your identity? And where have you felt that your identity was threatened? So I'm going to let people share if they would like to. But I'm not going to force anybody because obviously there are times where it's not prudent, but I will give an example. I don't have a great example from my own life because I'm very, as you know, kind of in your face. I don't have a way, but I do have my friend who I've mentioned before. His name is Ray, and he works for Kaleidoscope Ministries, which is an organization in New York that is specifically serving LGBT communities. That's all they do is they go out and they love on the LGBT community and want to bring them to Jesus. And Ray will not, no matter who asks, tell you what he believes scripture says about the LGBT community. He says, he'll be like, I understand the debate, but I'm not, even talking to him, me and him, he's like, I was like, what are you saying? He's like, I bring them scripture and I say, let's discuss it together. But he never, ever says. And the reason he never says is because Ray preaches at both conservative and liberal churches. And his goal, his calling from God is to help the church love the LGBT community better. And he says, once I say anything, I've already blocked myself from going to that church. And he's like, I have to come to this community, and my job is to help them feel love. So that is where he feels it's prudent to hide part of his identity or his beliefs. And I would agree with him because as you all know, when we officially decided to be side C, there was a lot of hurt on both sides. Because it's really hard to be in a place where we say we can disagree. It's a lot harder to be in a place where we can say we can disagree than it is to go one way or the other. So that being said, has anyone felt like there was a time that it was prudent to hide part of your identity or that you felt your identity was threatened? Go ahead, Kelly.
So I work in a jail. And so I don't allow everyone I work with, both officers and incarcerated, to know, have access to all of me. Mm-hmm. You know, I am still authentic, I am still pleasant, and try to be respectful and compassionate towards everyone. But I'm also not busting out my soapbox, and I also need to keep parts of myself and my personal life safe.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
Yeah.
Thank you for sharing.
I've worked a lot of customer service jobs, so whenever you're talking to a person, and it could be any human being on planet Earth talking to you, you can't just like, you got to kind of match their energy and where they're at, because if you don't, it could end poorly, especially if it's an in-person situation. So, you know, I dozens of examples of not biting my tongue in other situations.
Yeah, for sure.
I have had to tell people before, like, they'll start talking about something that's a hot-button topic, and oftentimes I will agree with them, but I literally have told them, I'm sorry, as a library employee, I can't comment on that right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Like, no.
Yeah.
We'll be here all day if I do. No.
Mm-hmm.
there's kind of like a certain a degree of respect with the with what you're talking about when you're talking about withholding some of your and but there's also the part of your identity you don't want anybody to see because he's like, oh my gosh, what will they think of me if they know that's what I, you know, I mean, I love to go to the casino, so what are they going to think of me, you know? And so there you guys know it, you get to think.
We all are.
I felt like that a lot at my old church, which is a large reason of why I'm not there anymore.
Yeah.
It was like, if I told them who I was at all, really. Besides being the associate pastor's wife's best friend, anything beyond that would be a completely different story.
Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and yeah, so I know, actually, I take it back. So one thing, when I was going through the worst of my depression and anxiety, I was very ashamed of that. Now I'll tell, like, anybody within 5 minutes if it's appropriate. I don't just, like, spread out, by the way, nice to meet you, I have an anxiety disorder. But, like, I was so full of shame about it for so long because I was, like, afraid that fear. And that's where the second part, where is your identity felt threatened? Like, that is a part of me. I can't, as much as I would like to rip off that part of me, I can't. I can't just be like, well, I'm not going to be anxious ever again. Thank you, guys. Have a good one. So, I mean, yes, there are things that, where it's not safe, or we have a perception of it not being safe.
Or accepted.
Yeah, or accepted. Oh, go ahead, Kelly. Sorry.
Well, one of the times recently I feel like has been like at work.
Mm-hmm.
And it's basically been like, okay, so I was in the room with my manager and executive salesperson and someone else, right? And although I wasn't the only person of color in the room, they were talking about the recent elections and everything like that, and, you know, COVID and how things were lies and, you know, this is what we really need to do. And I just kind of stayed quiet. I was like, okay, some of my opinions don't align with these people, but these people are higher ups and I can't, like, I feel like if I voiced my opinion. It was a very awkward situation.
Yeah.
Very awkward.
Yeah.
So I was like, okay, I can't voice my opinion. But, you know, just like kind of holding your tongue kind of deal.
Yeah.
And recently, like, there's been things that have happened at the job I don't agree with.
Yeah.
And I opened up and vocalized my opinion to people, and it still has, things still don't seem like they're being resolved, and so now I don't know if I need to be an advocate or if I need to just be quiet about it, you know, so,
yeah.
I feel like if I try to be an advocate, will my job be threatened at this point? Yeah, so, definitely
yeah.
Work.
Yeah, for sure. Work can be a very difficult place.
First part of that just reminded me of a quote from Sense and Sensibility. I don't remember it exactly, but basically Eleanor's at a ball talking to a very annoying man. And she says, Eleanor agreed with it all because she didn't think he was worth an argument. She didn't think he was worth arguing with.
There you go. All right. Thank you all for sharing. For the sake of time, I am going to move us forward. But I, the reason I wanted to touch on this, too, is because I know as we talked about identity and authenticity, sometimes it can feel like, you know, we're living a lie if we're not always being 100% authentic or we're not sharing things. And that's not true, right? Like, there are times where it is very prudent to not share everything. But then, of course, Esther, in her situation, does end up having to share everything. So, right, going back to our friends Haman and Mordecai, right? So Haman is so upset because he won't bow down. He's like, I'm going to kill them all. Like, I'm going to kill all of the Jews, right? And so he releases this plot. And, like, him and Mordecai is like, well, we got to tell Queen Esther because she's queen, right? Like, she can do something about this. And we're going to see Queen Esther's response. So here we go. Hathach went back and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that they be put to death unless the king extends the gold scepter to them and spares their lives. But 30 days have passed since I was called to go to the king. Like, Esther is justifiably afraid. She's like, I understand there's this edict, right, that is going out. But also, I could die before the edict goes just by walking in. And King Xerxes does not have a good track record, right? His last wife said no to him and he got rid of her. Hammond just approached him with, like, I want to kill the Jews. And he's like, okay. So, like, King Xerxes is not, like, he is very temperamental. He's not someone you could trust to have a steady, steadfast opinion. And so, when Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, he sent back his answer. Do not think because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will rise from another place, but you and your father's family will perish. And who knows but that you have come to your royal position for such a time as this. And I love Mordecai's expression of faith here. Because he says, if you don't do it, God is going to bring somebody else. But he'll probably die anyway. But I love that. Because if you are a fantasy or sci-fi fan like I am, there's a lot of literature about the chosen one. It's a very common thing, right? And it's like, and there's always, if you follow the hero's journey, there's always the refusal of the call, right? And then there's like the, well, I'm going anyway. Like, and the thing is, we have the ability to say no to God, right? That is what free will is. And God's like, my plan is still going to happen, whether you say no or not. But I'm giving you the opportunity now to partner with me and to live in that blessing with me. But that's your choice, right? And so that's what Mordecai is saying. He's like, I know who God is. He doesn't even say God. So Esther invites us to see God behind the scenes. And that's one of the reasons I really like the book of Esther, because it never says God said this. It allows you to realize that God is still working in the background, even when he's silent. He's still moving. And Mordecai has this faith where he's like, it doesn't matter if you do this or not, because God's going to deliver his people. And he's like, but you'll probably die. Like, he does throw that little bit of shade in, and there is, like, but I think it's so important to remember that, because, like, we always have the ability to say no to God. The world doesn't rest on you. Like, the salvation of the world doesn't rest on you. That's on Jesus, right? But, like, you miss out on so much, and you feel so much pain when you do, right? And sometimes it leads straight to your death. But God is going to save his people regardless of your choice. All right. Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go, gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. It's very interesting because she doesn't say fast and pray. She just says fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my attendants will fast as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law. And if I perish, I perish. You can tell there's a Esther has gone, like, I don't think that's a good idea to, you're right, I don't really have another option, and we're going to go. Like, she makes a choice. Because in times in life, we have the ability to either make a choice or let the choice make us. Mm-hmm. If Esther didn't do anything, the choice would have made her, right? Mm-hmm. And she would have died regardless. So Esther decides to have courage in that moment and say, I get it. There is a 90% chance I'm going to die. Either here or here. So I'm gonna go here because this is like the only one where I think I might not. And then so Mordecai went away and carried out all of Esther's instruction. And so Esther finally gets some boldness here, right? Before that, she's kind of been a timid character. And she's kind of just done whatever Mordecai has said. And it's the first time she's like, Mordecai, no. And then he's like, yes, Esther. And she's like, okay. But she does do, like, and if I perish, I perish. I love that line because it's, you really see the, like.
It's like a meme now.
I did not know that, but there you go.
Church meme.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, that's one that gets quoted around a whole lot.
If I perish, I perish.
So perish.
There's that.
But also, again, and I think this is really important when we talk about courage and our identity, because everybody who's here, your identity is a Christian, right? And for you to remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will rise from another place. And I think about this a lot with our current administration, right? Sometimes it feels a lot easier to be silent. And there are so many things that universally, I would say, people can agree are wrong. But then if you attach it to a political party or a political name, all of a sudden it doesn't really matter because it's that person doing it or that, like, thing. And I know the permanent resident, and forgive me, I've forgotten his name.
Mahmoud Khalil.
Thank you. Who spoke up against the immigration and stuff and then had his green card revoked and, you know.
Got disappeared.
Yes, got disappeared, basically. Like, we should all be able to agree that that is wrong. And, like, that is something that requires us to speak up and speak out. Oh, meh, I don't want that one. Sorry. It's fine. All right, do not, and so, again, I already quoted it, I forgot to put it there. But you have the ability and the calling to speak out and speak up, right? You don't get to stay on the sidelines when evil happens. You know, there's that famous quote that people bring back all the time of the all it takes for evil to succeed is for good men to do nothing. And, like, we have to be able to stand up into our identity in Christ, and that takes courage, right? Because sometimes it's our financial job that's on the line, right? We've seen that with throughout layoffs, right? And sometimes, you know, it's like the squeaky wheel gets the grease, but it's also, you know, the nail that sticks out that gets hammered, right? And so, like, sometimes it's our jobs. Like, we are lucky enough that it's not typically, except for Mohammed Khalil, not usually our lives in this country, right? But we do, as Christians, that is one of those courageous things we have to be able to speak out against when there is injustice, right? Because I feel like this verse is almost a precursor because, but you and your father's family will perish. And, like, it kind of, it reminds me a lot of the, you know, the Holocaust poem, first they came for the Jews, but I didn't care because I was not a Jew. And then it goes, keeps going on. And then, like, well, then there was no one left to care for me. This feels like one of the first ones of those. And it's like, I am a documented citizen of the United States. But I know that doesn't necessarily, like, when you start letting things happen to other people and you let a president call people vermin, which is one of my, that is my line in the sand, is when you do dehumanize people, because once you dehumanize them, you are allowing them to be treated as inhuman, right? As animals. And it's a problem, right? And so, like, we have to stand. It doesn't even matter if you believe borders should be closed. It doesn't matter if you believe they should be deported. When someone ever, any position of power, your best friend, whatever, calls a group of people vermin, that is a time where you have to stand up and say, that's not right. Right? Like that, and that is, because eventually it does lead to extinction. Right? It's like, we're not there yet, by any means. But we are, you know, trying to deport people as fast as possible. And we are seeing ICE and different things dehumanize people and treat them really, really poorly. Right? There's been lots of that. Because once someone in power calls them vermin, all the people under him, right? Because remember, Hitler didn't kill 6 million Jews on his own. Right? Like, yes, we blame Hitler. But, like, he gave policies and he gave people permission to treat people, specifically Jews and gays and gypsies, forgive me, that's a slur, but a certain way. And so when Trump does that, the people who are working for ICE feel like they have the permission to treat humans as subhuman. And that's really hard. And that's something we have to speak out about, right? And that takes courage. It takes courage to be a Christian in that moment and say, that's wrong. And then we have Queen Esther, who is, okay, back to our story about Esther. Esther definitely has learned a little bit from her time in the political world, right? Because she doesn't, King Xerxes, she shows up, he gives her the scepter and says, what do you want? Up to half my kingdom, you can have it, right? Which is just, you know, that's kind of like when we say, oh, you know, I'll give you $1 million, or I pay, or, you know, I die for this, or whatever. That's what that is. And she's like, you know what I want? I want a banquet with you and Haman, and that's it, right? And I always laugh at that because I'm like, why on earth are you asking? Like, I would have never done that. This is not that. Like, I was like, and so she does. And then he's like, what is your request? We have this banquet. I know this isn't your real request. And she's like, well, my real request is that you come back tomorrow for another banquet. That's my real request. And
make sure you're well-fed and happy.
Yes, and and maybe a little drunk.
And not in front of your entire people getting embarrassed.
And then we get to this part of Esther towards the end. So the king and Haman went to Queen Esther's banquet, and as they were drinking wine on the second day, the king had asked, Queen Esther, what is your position? As you were, as Sarah mentioned, as they were drinking wine on the second day, right? Like he had, Queen Esther, what is your petition? It will be given you. What is your request? Even up to half the kingdom, it will be granted. Then Queen Esther answered, if I have found favor with you, your majesty, and if it pleases you, grant me my life. This is my petition. And spare my people. This is my request. For I and my people have been sold to be destroyed, killed, and annihilated. If we had merely been sold as male and female slaves, I would have kept quiet because no such distress would justify disturbing the king. King Xerxes asks Queen Esther, who is he? Where is he? The man who has dared to do such a thing. Esther said, an adversary and an enemy. This vile Haman. Right?
Dun, dun, dun.
Exactly right, right? Yeah.
Shock Pikachu.
And it's because Haman and the king both don't know that Esther's Jewish. It's like she doesn't go out and say I'm Jewish. She just says he ordered the destruction of my people. Well, there's only one group of people that Haman has ordered the destruction of, right? And so the end of the story, right? Everything ends poorly for Haman, right? He gets impaled on the pole that he wanted to impale Mordecai on. The Jews end up slaughtering his entire family so he doesn't get to survive, like the 10 sons. And all of that happens, and, you know, it has a very happily ever after feeling, which again makes me feel like this is more of a historical novel. Because most other scripture either ends abruptly or like, and then this happened and no one really liked this or da 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 da. But this has a very like, and they all lived happily ever after, and now we're going to have a festival.
Exactly. They couldn't change the law.
Well, yes, I'm just skipping that. So they couldn't change the law, so they had to let the Jews fight back, and then the Jews killed a bunch of people, and then we had a festival and a party, and they all lived happily.
It was civil war instead of a slaughter.
Yes. But it ends
with,
let's have a festival called Purim, and many Jews still celebrate it today, where there's lots of food and wine, and they say,
it's Jewish Christmas.
It's this, and they give gifts to one another. It is kind of.
And dress up in costume.
Yeah. So, and the main point I have for you today is we need the courage to be ourselves as well as the wisdom to know when to reveal ourselves, right? There is courage in choosing to say, this is who I am. This is who God has called me to be. This is something that is not okay and I need to speak out of. But there's also wisdom to know when it's not appropriate. Or when, you know, when to wait to share that you're a Christian. Yes, Luke.
I think there's also a when and how, because, like, a lot of, like, I watched the commentary, it was from a Jewish perspective, but that really went into the build-up before Esther made the request and how much she, like, buttered up and set it up so that King Xerxes would be predisposed to, you know,
mm-hmm.
She set the scene.
She did.
Yeah, it was not just a one and done. You know, there was, you know, the initial request, three banquets, and two banquets.
And that can feel, and that can feel manipulative to some of us, and to a part it is. But I think it's wrong when we think of manipulation as purely evil, because sometimes you can manipulate things for good. It just really depends on your wisdom there. Like I know Luke and I have discussed this at length, and like. But like I know in college there was someone who kind of tricked someone to come to an intervarsity thing and like then like they found salvation. And I know people are like, see Luke's face. You can just watch it on his Luke's face, he hates it. But I do believe that God uses those things. I did like, and it also depends on a friendship. It depends on a lot of things. I'm not saying go copy that, but I am saying that we can't just say like manipulation is bad. Like, it is often wielded inappropriately. That's what I will settle on.
She was also buttering up Haman because he was like, hey, I'm like the only one invited to this private dinner with the king and queen.
Mm-hmm.
I'm so awesome.
Yes, Mom.
Two things. If you've ever been to a chiropractor, you know manipulation is a good thing.
Yeah, that's
so,
there you
certainly
go.
Can be.
Yeah. The other thing is, I really don't like the idea of this being a novel. I mean, Hester is kind of a heroine of mine. And I really, you know, I do not like anything that would give any fiction or any manipulation to the story, because I believe it verbatim.
Okay.
You know? And so I do have kind of a little bit of a difficulty accepting that. But it could have been well written. Somebody could have just been inspired at the time to make it easily read, because it is a wonderful story.
Mm-hmm.
Or a wonderful...
Hamilton.
Yeah, it is an absurd.
Because it's made up doesn't mean it isn't true.
Yes. But I don't. It's not. I do not believe it's made up. I believe that it is a very real event told through someone who could write versus someone who was trying to record information.
And it took a lot of wisdom for Esther to react the way she did. I mean, mm-hmm. I might have said, okay, great, I'll perish, but I'm the kind of person that would bulldoze in. I would never have done the, you know, two papers, you know?
That's a lot of work.
Yeah, you know, so...
To be fair, I think all the Bible should be viewed through that lens. I think a great example of that is the Gospels, where it goes through the same events, but it highlights different points and it throws a different weight depending on the writer. So I think every single word in the Bible is told through the lens of someone who God is speaking through. So you have to always keep that in mind, that there might be some writer, whatever you want to say.
Well,
so I don't think that's really that
different. The other thing to remember is this time period... Oh my gosh, my brain is blanking. Not the Renaissance, but the thing, it starts with R. Anyway, there came a time when all we cared about was, like, knowledge and facts and all of that. And the Enlightenment. I got it. It does not. I was way off. It doesn't even have an R in it, but we're but I found it.
Yes,
since
the Reformation was the same time.
Yes, okay, that's, yeah, okay.
Or I was going to go with Renaissance.
No, okay, so when the Enlightenment happened, the Western world, for the most part, really was like, we only want facts and we want concrete things, and that's it. You can take your spirituality, you can take your, you know, like, we want to know what's real. And because of that, like, what we consider history is, it happened on this day, at this time, these people were present. Before that, when people, so you could actually probably argue that it is history in the way that they would have written history, because they weren't concerned with, this is the exact way it happened, it was at this time, and he was there, and she was there, right? So it is a different type of storytelling and a different type of recorded history. So it very much could be, this is the true history, because that's how they would have recorded history. You just have to remember that they weren't as obsessed as, like, you know, well, that's not real because she was actually wearing white and it says she was wearing cream, right? Like, because we're much more like that today, right? So, yes.
Yay.
All right, we're going to end today with this blessing. It's by Jan Richardson, and it's called Blessed Are You Who Bear the Light. So I'm going to read this over you guys, as you think about what it means to bear the light as you go about your week. Blessed are you who bear the light in unbearable times, who testify to its endurance amid the unendurable, who bear witness to its persistence when everything seems in shadow and grief. Blessed are you in whom the light lives, in whom the brightness blazes, your heart a chapel, an altar wherein the deepest night can be seen, the fire that shines forth in you an unaccountable faith, in stubborn hope, and love that illumines every broken thing it finds. Blessed are you who bear the light. Amen.
Amen.